This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks.
Ms. Murray is going to vote against this. She's voted against LGBT things, and she's voted against environmental things, making us 100% clean energy for all city employees. So all of those things, her voting record is against bringing talent here.
So I don't appreciate constantly being attacked. All of us have our votes. You can disagree with my votes. That's fine. But you can't just bring up your own facts. There's many things that I voted for, and many of those things you talk about, I have a majority that I voted for. There's a few I voted against, and that's that.
And that was a heated exchange between Cincinnati City Council members Chris Seelbach and Amy Murray. It came after a vote in favor of an ordinance prohibiting employers from asking the salary history of job applicants. The goal of the ordinance, supporters say, is to address inequities in pay between men and women. But it also further exposes the underlying tension at Cincinnati City Hall that was so visible during publicly released text messages between five members of council, including Seelbach, in which other members of council, including Murray and Vice Mayor Chris Smitherman, were the targets of criticism. So let's discuss the latest. Joining Cincinnati Edition, our Cincinnati Inquirer columnist, Jason Williams. Welcome back, Jason.
Thanks for having me back.
And WVXU reporter, Jay Hanselman. Welcome, Jay.
Hey.
Join the conversation, 513-419-7100. Email talk at WVXU.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter as well. We'll look for your comments and your tweets. So before we discuss that specific piece of legislation that council was voting on this week, are things tense at City Hall between members of council?
Sure sounds that way, doesn't it?
It does sound that way.
Yeah, and actually that one was kind of surprising. It was a rather routine ordinance. I expected most council members to make some comments. I knew there were going to be probably a couple council members opposed. And it just kind of nosedive pretty quick after Mr. Sittenfeld made some comments. Chris Seelbach agreed with him, and that's what you heard the exchange that we played.
So have the dynamics changed at all since this situation, the Gang of Five text messages came out?
Well, that was the first full council meeting since those came out, and apparently they haven't changed. Everyone was watching them closely to see, like, hey, how are they going to react? And clearly, it doesn't appear as if anything has changed. There's a lot of hurt feelings from what it was said in those text messages. And I think we're going to continue to see this tension and headbutting.
And there was no council member mentioned the text this week. There was a budget and finance committee on Monday with seven council members, the council meeting on Wednesday, which Vice Mayor Christopher Smitherman did not attend. And there were some public comment from folks who talked about the text, but council members themselves, it was never mentioned. The texts weren't mentioned.
Was it surprising at all that Councilman Seelbach, who has faced a lot of blowback in the wake of this text messaging situation, that he kind of went on the offensive over an unrelated issue?
I think it was more on the substance of the issue. I mean, he has had some issues with Ms. Murray in the past that especially on resolutions or anything involving LGBTQ issues, that she either votes against them or sometimes she doesn't even vote against them. She'll just physically get up and leave the council chamber so she doesn't have to vote. And that's bothered him. He's brought that up several times in the past. So I'm not sure it was so much about the text as, you know, what the issue was about.
And these are deeply personal issues to him, and I think that he's taken her votes or her stance, and I think it's really upset him, probably particularly that she has gotten up a handful of times, literally right before the vote would happen, and walked out. I haven't noticed that happening any time recently, but I think it happened a few years ago. But it's certainly, some personal issues to him that have been part of his agenda since he became on council in 2011, and I think we saw maybe some of his frustration come out there on Wednesday.
513-419-7100. If you'd like to join the conversation, talk at WVXU.org is our email address. We'll take your comments there as well. Jay, you kind of hinted at this a moment ago. One issue that may have led to reduced drama at the meeting this week was the absence of Vice Mayor Chris Smitherman. So he was not present at this week's meeting. So we don't yet know how he'll interact in that setting in a post-text message release world. But he did release some audio from his wife, who passed away recently from cancer. What's the story here?
I'll let the audio was hand delivered to the Enquirer, so I'll let if Jason probably can better answer that than I can.
Well, so yeah, it was released on Monday night, and it was an audio of Christopher Smitherman's wife before she passed away in January, sharing her frustrations with specifically P.G. Sittenfeld over what the Smithermans thought was a text message that Sittenfeld exchanged with Seelbach that was really critical of her and the Smitherman family. It was a very odd twist in this whole thing, and I wrote a column the day after the next day that it was a hard column to write because I think Christopher Smitherman is a genuine, straightforward guy. I feel for him. He's mourning. Everyone mourns in their own way. Whether he meant it this way or not, it certainly looked political. And I want to make that clear. Like, it just really looked political. And it's just an odd thing.
Because he's spoken about as a potential 2021 yes. mayoral candidate.
He actually has officially announced that he is running in 2021. Yeah.
And he may be up against Councilman P.G. Sittenfeld.
Correct.
And that was sort of the target of this
exactly.
released audio. So has P.G. Sittenfeld responded to this?
He has not responded specifically to the audio. He did come out last week after the text messages came out, and he did apologize for breaking the open meetings law. He has not, though, addressed the specific audio in which he was criticized by Mrs. Smitherman.
And I think a lot of people were surprised. I mean, I was greeted first thing, and I won't say who, on Tuesday morning appropriately enough with a text like, what was he thinking? The text to me said he sort of had the moral high road.
What was Smitherman thinking?
Right.
Yeah,
what was Smitherman thinking? That he was sort of on the moral high road. And, I mean, the comment to me in that text was he just fell off with the release of that audio. He fell off the – they thought that he fell off the moral highway.
Well,
high road.
It raises questions that – so in the text message exchanged last year between Seelbach and Sittenfeld, Smitherman was upset with Sittenfeld over some kind of an issue at City Hall. He went on another radio station and criticized Sittenfeld and at some point referenced his wife, saying, I'm dealing with my dying wife. That, unbeknownst to him at the time, that led to an exchange. Seelbach and Sittenfeld exchanged, like, hey, they thought he was using his wife's illness as a political gain. And what I thought happened then the other day, then it seemed that by releasing this audio, it almost was like it raised the question, like, did you almost kind of validate the point that you were trying to criticize? Like, that maybe they did have a point that you were trying to use this for political gain.
Interesting. So he played a hand, and it may not have gone the way he had expected.
Well, I think, was it Kevin Arledge? Do I have his name right? Wrote an op-ed.
Aldridge, opinion editor.
He wrote, maybe he was fulfilling Pamela Smitherman's wishes, that this is what she wanted to happen, and we don't know that.
Right. We don't know all the context yet, so we may learn more about that.
And we talked off the air. I'll be surprised the Law and Public Safety Committee meets on Monday morning, and that is chaired by Councilmember Smitherman. And I think if anything is to be mentioned, it could be during that meeting for a couple reasons. Number one, he's the chair of the committee, so he can talk as long as he wants about anything that he wants because he's the chair. The chair can cut you off, and if you're chair, you usually don't cut yourself off. And there are no Gang of Five members on that committee. The only other committee members are council members Jeff Pastor and Amy Murray, both who were not spoken highly of in the text of the Gang of Five. So I think if anything could happen with Mr. Smitherman commenting on the text, I look forward to maybe be Monday morning after they're done with the law and public safety agenda.
So the text message case lives on possibly Monday. The text message case is still riling up plenty of council critics. We have a piece of audio. Let's take a listen to a piece of sound from this week's meeting.
Great courage. Hide behind taxpayer dollars. Hide behind excuses. Blame the judge. Blame the jury. Blame the executioner. Blame whoever you want. But the fact of the matter is this. The five of you broke the law. And that's bad enough. But the most disappointing thing is the aftermath. Apologize for what you did. Apologize for breaking the law. None of you have apologized for what you said. None of you have apologized for the vitriol, for bringing up people's relationships, people's families, for making fun of people who invited you into their home. And you use mental illness as an insult, call them salty nuts, call them psychotic. So much hypocrisy here.
That was Tony Castelli laying into the Gang of Five. Are you sensing that there's a lot of anger among the public in relation to this case?
I am. Let me, if I want to make something clear, Tony Castelli is a Christopher Smitherman supporter. And if I could set the record straight, I will say that Greg Landsman, he has come out and really, I think, sincerely apologized. He really is the only one who just came right out at the beginning and said, I'm sorry, it was a mistake, I own it, it won't happen again, let's move forward, period. There was no blaming anyone else. There was no, straddling the line between it's partly someone else's fault. He just said, my fault, I'm sorry, period.
And this Castelli guy did go on after that portion that we listened to and targeted Landsman, I think, more than the others with his criticism.
But to answer your question, I was surprised that I thought people would be – I thought it would really polarize people more, but there have been a – the feedback has been people are really upset about this, and even people who – I've gotten emails of people saying, hey, I support these folks, the Gang of Five generally, and I'm not happy about them breaking open meetings laws. I also was a little surprised that a lot of their supporters have been, for the most part, really quiet on social media, with a handful of few people. So it really tells me that there's, I think, generally overriding that there's a general disappointment there in those five council members.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We're talking about Cincinnati City Hall and the fallout from the text messaging case involving five members of council. We're joined today in the studio by Cincinnati Inquirer columnist Jason Williams and WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. I'm watching some of these reactions unfold on Twitter, and it's easy to get caught up in the Twitter bubble, but when you're watching it, it seems that none of the so-called Gang of Five council members can tweet about anything now without critics of their actions, critics of this text case, calling for their resignation, no matter what the subject matter is. Have the responses from those five members of council evolved at all since last week, Jay?
I don't think so, and I think it's highly unlikely that any of them are going to resign anytime soon. The only qualifier I'd put on that is, because I had to look this up because I wanted to be sure, after June 1st of this year, any council member who cannot is term limited, which are six members, and that would be three of the Gang of Five.
Yes, yeah.
After June 1st, if they step down, they can name their appointment, so to speak, and there doesn't have to be a special election to fill their seat. So I've long suspected perhaps maybe Councilmember Young might step down early, not because of the texting case, but he might look at it as, if I step down after June 1st, I can get somebody ahead up. A step ahead in the 2021 election. I'm not sure Councilmember Seelbach, at one time I would have said, would guaranteed that Councilmember Seelbach was going to do that after June 1st. Not so sure I'm there now, but I think people may read into that, oh, look, they're resigning because of the text thing. I'm not sure that's going to be the case. I think if they do, it's going to be because it gives somebody a step ahead for 2021.
Jason, who do you think has handled this the best? I know you just referenced Greg Landsman, but I'd like your perspective on who's handled it the best, who's handled it the worst from a political and PR standpoint.
Well, I'd reiterate that I think Greg Landsman has really handled it the best. And I also know behind the scenes that he's really trying to bring both sides together and talking to council members and the mayor and saying, like, look, this, we have to pivot from this and people have to start being civil and the discourse has to change. So I give him a lot of credit for that. In terms of how it was handled, I think when you really take into consideration that he wants to be the, or he's, that's an open secret that P.G. Sittenfeld is going to run for mayor. When you think about his potential and the fact that he has a lot of supporters and voters, he's been the number one vote getter the last two elections. That's anyone. I have to say that he's been the biggest disappointment in this whole thing. He orchestrated the original quorum of text messages, and I truly believe was deliberate. And then he came out last week, initially came out and put out a 5-6 paragraph statement. The first two graphs were showed contrition, and then the next three were about blaming political opponents. It kind of gets back to what I was talking about with Landsman. It's like he just didn't come straight out and own it, period, move on. And so, yeah, I think of him as the biggest disappointment. And now it's like, how is he going to pivot away from this and move forward? Still 2.5 years until the election.
And the thing about Landsman, too, I'll say, he was the only one who stuck around the courthouse after the case was over. The other four were gone. Well, with the exception of Wendell Young, whose attorney spoke for him. But three of the five were out the door as quick as they could get out the door. You know, and Greg stuck around. And matter of fact, I talked to him, and then people saw that we were talking, and the rest of the media came. And he didn't bail out. He answered all the questions until the media stopped asking questions.
So, Councilman Sittenfeld mm-hmm. is going to have the baggage of this text message case, and now Councilman Smitherman may have overplayed a hand. I don't want to be insensitive about the contents of his message, but the way it's being received, it sounds like there's been some blowback from this release of a recording of his wife expressing some criticism of this case as well. Jason, you wrote in a column in which you said that the longer Sittenfeld and Smitherman do battle, the more they open the door for an outside candidate. What gives you that perspective?
Well, you know, we see this in government all the time. That government and politics are so yucky and a mess right now that, if you can come in and you have this kind of outsider, quote, outsider, and someone who's not a part of the mess right now can come in with a clean message and saying, I can clean up the mess. We saw Mark Mallory do that back in 2005 against David Pepper, and Alicia Reese was running at the time. And she was a council member. David Pepper was a council member. Let me make this clear. City Hall was not anywhere near the mess it's been. And those two council members were, I think, in good standing in their party and with their voters. But Mallory, with a big name, came in. He had never been at City Hall before. He was a state in the state house for a long time. Came in and said, I bring a new message. It's clean. And people said, let's do it. And as the longer this thing drags on, again, 2.5 years is a really long time in politics. But the longer this drags on, and I sense that there are some people who are trying to drag it on, the more I think this builds a case for that person to come in with that clean message to say, you know, I hate to say it, but, you know, drain the swamp, clean up the chaos kind of thing.
But and the other thing you have to think about, too, the Enquirer got a significant ruling Wednesday mm-hmm. From the Ohio Court of Claims that now puts on in a record that individual text, as if an individual council member is discussing a city issue on a personal cell phone, personal email, it is a public record. So, the Enquirer had sued to get that information. I think you have to refine it a little bit about what you're actually asking for.
Yeah.
But there could be more text coming out. So now we've got the Gang of Five text. This might be stupid, but we could get the Gang of Four from the other four who could have possibly texted about this. We could get text from Harry Black, who was also involved, that led to the Gang of Five text. We could also get the mayor's text on this. So this, it could fill in some holes. It could open up some new holes once those texts came out. So this could be the gift that keeps on giving for perhaps another year as we're compiling all these different texts. I can't imagine that the Enquirer is not going to ask for those if they haven't asked for them already.
I mean, this case is setting some new open records precedent, and it's certainly the argument. I've really kind of gone back and forth on this because at first I was like, you know, I don't know if an individual text message between two people on council is a public record. But then when you start, the other side of it though is if these two individuals were to email, that is a public record. And so what really is the difference? Well, you know, texting, you can make the arguments, the new way of picking up the phone and calling, and but the judge has ruled and said that these are public records.
513-419-7100. If you'd like to weigh in, we've got Scott on the line. Hey, Scott, what's your question or comment?
Hi there. Just a few comments and then a question. First, I really appreciate, Howard, your commentary and actually going through all those texts. It really, it brought some facts that I was looking for. Second, other than Landsman, I voted for all five of the gang, but I'm no longer a supporter of the four other than Landsman because no one's owned up to it. So my question is there any censure in the city government for breaking the open meetings law? And it seems like if the suit had not been brought up by Coast, nothing would have happened. So that's my question.
All right, Scott, thanks for listening and thanks for the call. We'll hang up and let the guys answer. Anybody know the answer to that?
I don't know that there's any censor in the city charter. And the other thing is, if it would have to be passed by a majority of council, 5-4, I don't see the gang of five censoring themselves.
I believe there is, like, the I think it would be a super majority of council could vote to censure someone, but ultimately—
That would take 6 or 7 votes.
Yeah, and really, what does a censure do? You still don't have to resign. There's no repercussions there in that standpoint. Scott, there's, as I think you probably know, that there's no recall in the city charter. There is some talk, and I haven't really taken a dive into this yet, but there is some talk. Apparently, there is a state law that allows voters to go to probate court, and then somehow that gets kicked back to the city solicitor, and then the city solicitor can decide whether to pursue an effort to try to get someone to resign or off of council.
And one other thing I heard yesterday on another radio station, the state auditor, who I think is Keith Faber, was talking about the release of the city audit. And he mentioned that perhaps next year when they do the city audit that they could try to make a finding against the gang of five. Now, four of the five, I think, have repaid the $1,000 fine that they got for violating the open meeting law. But he indicated that perhaps that in next year's audit of the city that they could try to have a finding against the five to make them also help to repay the legal fees, which was the balance of the $101,000 of the settlement. $90,000 of it was legal fees to the Coast law firm for their role in filing the lawsuit. Now, and he didn't guarantee that that would happen, but he said it was a possibility, and that being the state auditor.
We got a question from Aaron. He'd like to know if either of you knows about open meeting violations in other cities or any comparisons to here. I know they've happened, of course, but anything high profile that comes to mind?
No,
I noticed more frequently that city governments and county governments and such are sending press releases out just in the off chance that a majority of the members of the governing body might be at some event just to protect themselves from this. So there seems to be a heightened awareness.
I mean, I don't know how many village, municipal, county, city governments there are in the state of Ohio, but I would say a vast majority of them at some point, maybe not intentionally, probably at one time have probably skirted the Open Meetings Act. And sometimes it can be innocent enough that, you know, if you have two of three county commissioners at an event and, you know, they're talking about something that maybe is going to be on the agenda, if they talk about that item that's going to be on the agenda and there's two of them out of three, that's a majority and that would be a violation.
Yeah, there's certainly not been that I can think of recently around here that have been this high profile. Let's be straight and honest. This was incredibly political as well. But at the end of the day, they violated the law. There was already precedent by the state Supreme Court that you cannot conduct a meeting of a quorum, a public meeting, without via text message or email. I do know, having been at the Inquirer for 7 years and also covered business, I covered the airport board. I knew there were some issues with the airport board several years ago with some potentially violating open meetings laws. The UC board, I think a few years ago, there were some questions about that regarding, I can't even remember the issue, so I don't even want to say it. But like Jay said, that there are some skirting that's going on here. There are bodies that are allowed that have in their bylaws to go to executive session. At the end of the day, they're only allowed to go to executive session for real estate, personnel, and a business dealing. But once they close that door, who knows what the heck they're talking about? And unless you got a good person in there who's willing to leak the actual real information,
and council has been whacked on the hand before for open meetings for round robins. The Inquirer yep. sued about that. So basically what that, you know, you would go talk about an issue with four council members and then go maybe discuss it with two others trying to build a consensus. And
clever.
The court said, no, you can't do that either.
So there was some other business at City Hall this week, and I want to get to that with you, Jay, and we'll run through that very briefly. Before that, though, Jason, just on this same topic, the column that we referenced earlier, you also named 10 potential outside candidates mm-hmm. for mayor. Some of them are very familiar names. Mark Mallory, in a possible return to Denise Driehaus from the Hamilton County Commissioner. But some are lesser known in terms of the world of politics. Bob Bonder, a co-founder of Rheingeist. Chuck Mingo, one of the lead pastors at Crossroads. And listeners can see the full list and analysis at Jason's column. But what do you think the likelihood is that the 2021 landscape would be such that a political novice could take a stab at the mayor's seat?
If you were to really say, force me to give you an answer, I would say it would be tough for a political novice to do it. Not so much that they couldn't come in and make some waves, but I think the mess at City Hall discourages good people. And the mess that's in American politics right now, I'm concerned that it discourages good Democrats, good Republicans, good independents from running for office, and even people who have never run before who think that maybe they could do a good job and would do a good job would just sort of say, I don't want to. I make more money in the private sector, and I do not. I can make a bigger impact by not going down to City Hall or Capitol Hill or wherever.
Let me. I know that a lot of attention is going to be on the mayor's race in 2021, but the council race. Yep. Fasten your seatbelts because you're going to have six potentially open council seats, and you only have nine to start with. And there's a pause. And I've even been told that it could be seven, that one of a current incumbent that may not run again. So if you had seven of nine council seats that are first time on the ballot, fasten your seatbelts because it's going to be some good political theater.
Absolutely.
So, Jay, in our last minute here, let's run through some
lightning round
pieces of legislation that made its way through City Hall. Absolutely. We'll start back with what we started our conversation with, the salary ordinance.
That will ban that will take effect in a year, and basically employers in Cincinnati will not be able to ask a job applicant for their salary history, and the idea is to close the wage gap between men and women.
Over the Rhine residential parking program.
There are 500 residential parking permits for Over the Rhine. This week they voted that 200 of those will be flexible spaces that would be open to basically patrons and workers and Over the Rhine during the business or daytime from 9 in the morning till 5 in the evening.
Liberty Street.
That's an interesting one. They're still talking about this road diet. You know, dieting is hard. Apparently, even dieting for a road is even more difficult. There's this competing plan between either keeping it seven lanes or making it five lanes. Council's been on the record, a majority, that they support the five lane, and they voted to do that again this week. The only matter is that enough to actually force the city administration to actually begin the project to make the five lane happen?
I think you would have been pretty good on the $25,000 pyramid. Our thanks to Cincinnati Inquirer columnist Jason Williams and WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
Up next, Shriners Hospital leaving Cincinnati and moving to Dayton. We'll discuss what it means. And later, he served 25 years in prison after killing his family and holding classmates hostage at Ryle High School in Boone County. Now Clay Schrout is up for parole. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. For 50 years, Shriners Hospital for Children has treated kids from the U.S. and other countries for acute burns and other issues, and now it's preparing to say goodbye to the Queen City as it heads north to Dayton. We talk about that now with Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Ann Saker. Welcome, Ann.
Thank you so much.
And WVXU reporter Ann Thompson. Welcome, Ann.
Thank you, Michael, for
having
me. Two
Anns are better than one. We're glad to have you both here
to
talk about
this.
If you'd like to talk about Shriners Hospital, if you have some memories or some perspective on this, give us a call, 513-419-7100. Email talk at wvxu.org or check us out on Facebook or Twitter. We'll find your comments or your tweets there. Anne Sager, let's start with you. 50 years for Shriners in Cincinnati. What prompted the decision to leave?
This is a decision that's been long in coming for lots of intriguing reasons. First of all, the model of financing healthcare has changed significantly. But more to the human point, there's just not that many kids suffering burns that require extended hospital stays for lots of reasons. One, fire-resistant clothing, smoke alarms, better fire education, better treatment of burns. So the hospital was just having fewer and fewer patients. In fact, when they moved into the building in 1992, that's when they expanded the care spectrum to include things like cleft palate, spinal cord injuries. So they had to try and pull in some more care. Shriners International took great pride in this hospital system as their major philanthropic endeavor. And the promise was, we will pay everything. Transportation, hotel, your care will all be covered by this. Well, as there were fewer people joining Shriners, there were fewer people raising money, and that was colliding with the shortage of patients. So we had a lot of things that have been bubbling up for almost a decade and were leading to this particular point.
And Ann Thompson, for the patients in need of the care that is provided by the Shriners, what will the alternative be here now?
So Shriners, in its move to Dayton, is joining up with Dayton Children's Hospital, and they are going to have space in the same campus. It's going to remain a distinct hospital, and they're saying that as far as the patient care, it'll remain here in Cincinnati until they're ready for patients to move up there, which I think was in 2020, I read.
Correct.
In the news release when they made the announcement. So they're waiting for papers to be signed, and then they're going to start moving up there and getting the space ready.
And Shriners is also known for providing transportation. Isn't that
yes.
something that they do
That's
as well?
That's one of the components of the care that they provide.
So in the article that you wrote for the Inquirer, Anne Sager, you and Inquirer reporter Sheila Vilvins included a comment from Kylie Brookbank.
Yes.
And she lives in Georgetown, Ohio. She wrote a book, Beautiful Scars, A Life Redefined. And she was treated at the hospital here in Cincinnati back in 2014 and has since, according to your article, raised nearly $300,000 for it. Can you tell us about her reaction to this news that it was moving?
She was in transit with her mother from Florida on spring break. So we caught her statement while she was changing planes. And she was exceptionally disappointed, did not really know that this was going to happen this week. And I think that she is, what she told us was simply that she is glad that the care will still be available, that it's moving out of Cincinnati was heartbreaking for her. She's raised a lot of money for this facility because it saved her life. And it saves the lives of a lot of kids with burns. I wrote a story in 2016 about a young woman who came all the way from Rohtak, India. She had suffered a horrible facial burn from an acid attack. And she came here to live in Cincinnati with a family in Reading and got treated at the Shriners Hospital. She's now a happy and thriving young woman at UC Blue Ash, who I expect will one day rule the world because she's such an amazing person. But all that happened because she was here in Cincinnati.
Is that sort of the general sentiment that we're seeing from the public in terms of this announcement, that this is a sad situation?
I think it's sad because people think it's sad because this has been, if you drive up Burnett Avenue at any time, you cannot miss the Shriners symbol on this beautiful building that's parked in between Children's Hospital and UC campus. It's an institution here in the city. And so there's that. There's a sadness of that leaving, of course. But the reasons for it leaving are kind of great. There are not that many burn injuries that require hospitalizations anymore. It's a victim of its own success, sad to say.
And as Anne was mentioning, as far as the kind of the changing of healthcare, we were talking beforehand that the few times I had been over there just to do other stories with the hospital, just anecdotally, I just noticed that there weren't that many people at all over there. Like, there was nobody in the lobby. I think you mentioned, like, the second floor was vacant or didn't have too many people.
Right. Yeah.
What is the experience like here in Cincinnati for a patient who's taken to that hospital? What does it look like inside? What is the care experience?
So I personally haven't experienced it, or I've had.
Well, that's what I mean. It's like, I mean, what does it look like in there? Is it something that
makes? So it
looks
like a hospital, but obviously there's some very, and I'm not too sure about burn care, but you know, very intensive kind of treatment, I would imagine.
There are exceptionally dedicated doctors, nurses, and caregivers who love that hospital. When they had their grand reunion of patients last year to celebrate their golden anniversary, there is a nurse there who's been there 46 years. There are patients who came from all over the country for this reunion. The hospital inside is actually kind of cute. It's painted to look like a kiddie-sized small town with, you know, awnings, and it's very friendly and warm, and there's a playground in the middle. There's a huge atrium that lets in all this natural light. So it's a beautiful facility on the inside, but the halls echo. And you can tell that at one time this was a bustling medical facility. So it'll be intriguing to see what happens next. I would think that one of the medical institutions in the city would love to have it. We just don't know yet. I didn't.
You're talking about the building itself.
Yes. Yeah, UC declined to comment on it. Children's Hospital declined to comment on it. So I don't know. We don't know the future of this building yet. And to be clear, they've only signed a memorandum of understanding, Shriners Hospital, with Children's Hospital in Dayton. So they still have to actually sign a legal contract to make sure all this happens. So there's still some hoops to be jumped before they actually make this occur.
And I was wondering about the trends for Burns hospitals across the country, if they're also consolidating.
I think that's probably true. It's just that the nature of it is changing. And a lot of larger hospitals have their own burn units now, so there may not be the need for this niche care. So we'll see how this progresses. It's kind of an interesting medical financial story here.
You mentioned that UC had no comment on the building. Who owns the building?
The Shriners Hospital owns the building at the moment.
It's on Burnett Avenue.
It's on Burnett Avenue as you're going north into, and the neighbor literally across the street is Children's Hospital, and to the west is UC. So it's right on Pill Hill. You can't miss it. And I always get a little flutter in my heart when you go by and you see the big Shriners symbol on the front, because that's a phenomenal philanthropic and service organization in the country. And I'll be sad when they take that down.
What about the employees? Do we know anything about what the situation is for the medical staff that works there? Will they be moving as well?
Well, what I am understanding is that they have all been, you know, offered jobs, or they can continue with their employment when they move north to Dayton. So I think that's what they had mentioned in their news release.
Our thanks to Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Ann Saker and WVXU reporter Ann Thompson for this discussion. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. In a time before school shootings were a more regular occurrence in America, one local case gripped the nation's attention. In the early 90s, Clay Shrout murdered his family and took students hostage at Ryle High School in Union, Kentucky. He's been in prison for 25 years, but he's now up for parole. Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Cameron Knight joins us to discuss. Thanks for coming, Cameron.
Thank you.
If you want to join the conversation, it's 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Cameron, I think we have to start at the beginning because this was a long time ago. Who is Clay Shrout? What did he do?
So he was a teenager. He was a junior at Ryle High School in Boone County. And he, by all accounts, was a really bright guy, smart, did well in his classes. But toward the end of the time when he was not in trouble, I guess we'll word it that way, his friends started noticing some depression. Some claimed that he was becoming obsessed with death and gore. He was also having some spats with his parents about his grades. They took away his truck, some stuff like that. He was getting in trouble. He quit his job. And then one morning, he woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning and got a hold of a gun. I think there's a little bit of a question about where that gun came from, if it was a family gun or not. It wasn't widely reported back then where some of this stuff came from. So it's a little hard to tell, but he walked into his parents' bedroom, shot his mother, shot his father. The noise woke up his older sister. He had two sisters. They were both teenagers that were younger than him. So the noise woke up his older his oldest sister, who was younger than him, and he shot her, and then he shot his youngest sister. And then he left his house. He made a couple phone calls to friends and told them what happened, and some of them kind of believed him, kind of maybe didn't, where they weren't sure what to think. And then he drove to his prom date's house and picked her up. She went to a different school. And then they drove. It's a little unclear about whether it was an abduction or whether she was a little bit more of a willing participant. And then they went to Ryle High School, and he went to his first period class. He was a little bit late, but he went into school just like he normally would to his first period class. And he told his teacher, when she demanded an explanation, he told his teacher that, I heard someone was holding a class hostage. And when she asked who, he said me and pulled out a gun.
Oh, so, wow.
Luckily, standoff is probably a little bit of a strong word, but the situation with inside the classroom only lasted about 15 to 20 minutes. And a vice principal came in and was able to talk him out of holding the gun and got the gun away from him, and the cops were able to take him into custody.
So this was 1994. He was 17 years old. And you say that he called friends after the shooting. Now, was there any warning to the school that this student may be coming to school with a gun?
Not that we could tell. There were the way that the administration found out was that the teacher, who was a longtime teacher there and actually taught in that same very classroom until 2015. She never changed classrooms. His teacher tried to kind of calm him down and everything, but eventually someone came to class to just like get something signed or to stop by. And as the teacher was talking to her at the doorway, the teacher was able to mouth to the student, "Someone's got a gun. Go get help." And that student went and alerted the main office, and that's how everything kind of kicked into motion.
You mentioned that Clay Shrout faced some discipline at home for behavior or issues in his life at the hands of his parents, taking away his truck, for example, I think you said. But what do we know about his family just in general? What were they like?
Well, they were the mom and dad were high school sweethearts. They both worked. They owned horses, and both of the younger daughters rode horses in shows and things like that. And it's the area that they lived in, Tiburon Drive in Boone County is just a typical kind of suburban neighborhood. It seems like, again, on the surface, it seems like kind of a normal suburban family on a normal suburban street. So,
do they have any relatives that are still in the area?
It was hard to tell. So I did try to look into that side of it. There were mentions of a grandmother and some like aunt and uncle type people who were mentioned in articles from the time. It was pretty hard to track any of those people down, even if they would have wanted to talk. So there may be family still around, but as someone said, who was vehemently against him getting out on parole, he killed his entire immediate family that day. So
So now he is up for parole. There any effort by prosecutors or those affected by these crimes to stop his release?
So there have been, and I say anecdotally, meaning that there's been a huge discussion about this in the Boone County community. About how it will all, whether he should get out or not. And a lot of people don't believe he should. And so there are – the way that Kentucky parole works is that people can write letters. They can send messages to the court system. But the parole hearing itself is just the parole board and the inmate. So it's not – I know in some other states they have people can come testify and talk or whatever, but in Kentucky, that's not how it works.
Yeah, so, sometimes there's a letter-writing campaign or that sort of thing.
Yeah, and I think there have been a fair amount of people who have said and who have shared the information on how to write letters. So it seems like there's probably a fair amount of interest in his release or non-release, whichever side you fall on, but he but it doesn't seem like there. I mean, I don't think there's been any big announcements of like groups coming out against it or anything like that. But
if you're around in Northern Kentucky in the early 90s when this took place and you're still around, you don't really forget about Clay Shrout, but you may forget how chilling it all was. And you wrote in your article, I'm going to read a piece of your article, which was very well written to describe the events. I'll read this quote. The sole account of what happened that Wednesday morning comes from Shrout's best friend, Richard Brown. Shrout called him around 6 a.m. Brown said Shrout woke up with the intent to kill his parents. The rest of the conversation he recounted to reporters at the time. Shrout said he got up at 5 a.m., armed himself with a .380 caliber pistol, walked into his parents' bedroom. He shot his mother first, then his father. The noise brought Kristen, the sister, to the doorway of her own room where she was also gunned down. Shrout didn't say how he shot and killed his sister, Lauren, but did say he shot his father a second time as he crawled toward the door of his bedroom. And then the friend, Brown, says, he, Clay, told me, I wish it was a dream. I wish I could wake up. So you see, even right there at the beginning of this situation, that Shrout was expressing what seems to be remorse. Do we have any indication of what might be presented in Shrout's plea to be released this time, that he was remorseful even at the beginning, always was?
Well, so we talked to I talked to a person who was in that classroom, a student named Aaron Gillum. And he's had some familiarity with the case and heard some of the testimony or some of the interviews that Shrout gave to police. And he was under the impression that that Shrout, who, again, he knew, was completely remorseless in the aftermath of the shooting. As far as Shrout himself, he has been largely silent. Some other media outlets have reached out to him. We didn't have time to do sort of a back and forth letter thing to try to see if he wanted to talk to us or not for this story. But it seems like he's been quite silent on it. I did reach out to his attorney from back then, and his attorney from back then had no comment on it. So it was it's a situation where we just don't know a whole lot. And because there was never a trial, Clay Shrout accepted a plea deal. Basically, in order to avoid the death penalty, his lawyer at the time, I'm paraphrasing, but his lawyer at the time basically said people around here aren't afraid to give the death penalty. So he felt like if it had went to trial and a jury that his client would have been killed. Then he so they took this plea deal. And as part of that, he was never forced to testify, never forced to give any account of what happened, never asked to give any motivation for why he did what he did.
Again, this was 94. This was before Columbine. Did the Clay Shrout incident in which he brought a gun, of course, he killed his parents at their home, but he brought the gun into the school and probably scared some classmates with it. Did it change anything with school security in that era?
Well, I mean, Boone County has always sort of prompted by this incident, has always been pretty on top of their game with they were one of the first schools in Kentucky to bring school resource officers into all of their schools. They did do some work to really try to amp up their security. But I don't think it was really – even at the time, there was a lot of talk about school violence. But Columbine really changed the game.
Cameron Knight from the Cincinnati Inquirer. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our show are found online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.